Appeals is now in session. Judge Brian, Chief Judge Siegel, Judge Clary, the Honorable Jeffrey M. Ryan presiding.
Thank you. You may be seated. Good morning. Today is November the 3rd. We have, four cases scheduled for oral argument this morning. Why don't we go ahead and call the first case, please?
Calling case number A220468, State of Minnesota Respondent versus Christy Jeanette McNeely Appellate.
All right, and before you proceed, I know you're familiar with our process here and our rules, but you do have a choice which podium to use. If you want to use the one in the middle, that's fine. It does adjust if you need to adjust it. And then the only other thing I would ask is that if you could pronounce your name and the name of your client, and also let us know how you'd like us to refer to you and your client during your arguments this morning.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Robert Richman. And you may refer to me as Mr. Richman. I represent Christy McNeely, the appellant in this case. Ms. McNeely was a criminal defense attorney who was accused and ultimately convicted of swindling one of her clients of $15,000. As part of its investigation, the police obtained and executed a search warrant at her home law office. They seized a number of computers and electronic storage devices containing over 1,500 client files. The search warrant and subsequent warrant for the contents of the electronic devices were constitutionally unreasonable because they provided no procedure to protect against infringing on the attorney-client and work product privileges.
Counsel, excuse me, Marin, is that true, or did they not do what they needed to do and get two warrants and then get an expert to review it aside from them and walled off from them? I'm trying to figure out what was unreasonable, what they did.
What was unreasonable, Your Honor, is that while they invoked a procedure to determine which of the vast array of client files they seized were relevant to the investigation, they did not take the additional step of determining whether those relevant materials were protected by either attorney-client or work product privilege. They used a law enforcement employee, Meredith Peek, with the Dakota County Electronic Crimes Task Force to conduct a review of the materials. She used search terms, which hit on, at times, hundreds of documents, at times, thousands of documents. She then performed a manual review. Her sole function was to determine whether the documents that she hit upon, using search terms like the name of the victim, the name of the police officer who was allegedly implicated in this bribery scheme, confidential informant form, these were broad terms, and she then did a manual review of the documents. But her sole function was to determine, are these documents relevant? There was no one, she was certainly not trained or competent to make a determination of whether those documents were protected by privilege. She was.
Richman, if I can jump in and ask, do you know, or maybe you can refresh the panel on what was argued to the district court about the need for a special master instead, or appoint some kind of neutral person to review this or review it in camera, or what motions were made regarding this, let's say, the filter terms?
Well, originally the search was conducted, and 3 days later, Ms. McNeely, with counsel, made a motion under the statute for return of property. That was the KM litigation that went to the Supreme Court. In that litigation, I don't believe there was a specific request for a special master. At that time, Ms. McNeely had not been charged. She did
that
not.
That seems like a separate thing. That's about returning something.
Right.
But and what motions were made about the filter terms or the process?
The search had been conducted at that time, so there was no opportunity to weigh in on what the search terms should be or who should conduct the review because it had already been completed. It was simply a motion to suppress based on, number one, that the attorney-client and work product privileges had been violated, and number two, that the warrants themselves were overbroad.
Counsel, there isn't any obligation under Minnesota law to appoint a filter team or special master in this situation, is there?
Well, the closest case that we have is O'Connor versus Johnson. That case is somewhat distinguishable because there the attorney was not suspected of criminal activity. In that case, the court said the dangers, the risk to the privileges is so great that where the attorney is not a suspect, it is unreasonable to proceed with a search warrant, and the police are required to use a subpoena.
But as you said, this is not O'Connor, and
it's not O'Connor, Your Honor. But it's our position that the concerns of the O'Connor court do not simply disappear when the attorney whose office is the subject of a search is the target of the investigation.
So did the O'Connor court define the contours of this Fourth Amendment right that an attorney has that seems to be different than a non-attorney?
Well, the O'Connor court used very broad language about the importance of the attorney-client and work product privileges, discussed at length the historical basis of those privileges, how they are fundamental to the proper operation of the judicial system, and the Fifth and Sixth Amendments to the Constitution. And so it's our position that those concerns don't simply vanish because the attorney is the target of the investigation.
But you'd agree there's a bit of an implicit holding that you're asking us to identify regarding, you know, applying the exclusionary rule in this instance as opposed to some other remedy for a violation of some work product or attorney-client privilege, right? That's not explicit in O'Connor.
Correct. That's true. I concede that, Your Honor. But I think that what informs O'Connor and informs this case as well is that under the Fourth Amendment, a search to be constitutional must be reasonable. And given the language of O'Connor, a search which, while granted, takes steps to ensure that only relevant documents are reviewed, does nothing to ensure protection of the privilege, is constitutionally unreasonable.
And I guess that's I appreciate you articulating it that way, because I don't think this court or the Minnesota Supreme Court has done so to this point.
True.
And so to a degree, you are asking us to state it in a way that hasn't been stated before. Do you think that this should, if we agree with you, should be a precedential opinion?
Yes, Your Honor, absolutely. I think that the issues in this case could not be more important because the sanctity of the privileges are at stake in this case.
Mr. Richmond, if I could ask you a quick question. What I'm struggling with is why should your client benefit from this? I could see her other clients, if there was information that incriminated them that was found during the search, that they would be entitled to application of the exclusionary rule, perhaps. But why should your client, who was convicted of this crime, I mean, why should she be the beneficiary?
Well, first, the law is clear that the attorney has standing to invoke the rights of her clients with respect to the attorney-client privilege. In addition, the second privilege, the work product privilege, belongs to both the client and the attorney. So that is a privilege that protects her because it is protecting her own thought processes, her own deliberative process in preparing cases for her clients. That protects both the clients and her, and so for both of those reasons, as a practical matter, if she does not invoke the privilege on behalf of her clients, the privilege will not be invoked at all. It won't be protected. But for both of those reasons, we believe that she has standing to make this argument. It's also our position that the warrants in this case were overbroad and failed to adequately particularize the items to be seized. The law office search warrant authorized the seizure and search of every computer, laptop, hard drive, flash drive, or other digital storage device that the police found. There were no limitations. The search was not limited to documents pertaining to Mark Wilson, the victim of the crime. It was not limited to these allegations of swindle. It was not limited to a particular time period. The only relevant time period here was from March to November of 2018, yet this authorized all documents from time immemorial.
Mr. Richmond, I do have a question before you get too far into this argument about our standard of review. There are lots of cases in which we defer to the issuing judge and call it the substantial basis test. If there was a substantial basis that the issuing judge, the judge signing the warrant, could have found probable cause, then we'll defer to that. When we're looking at a challenge to the four corners of a warrant, now this seems to be a little bit different, but also you're challenging essentially the specificity of the application.
Correct.
So it is on the four corners. You wouldn't need an evidentiary hearing followed by findings to which we would review for clear error. So what do you think the standard of review is here on your challenge to the particularity or specificity of the items to be seized and searched?
I think this is a legal issue subject to de novo review. I agree this is turns on the four corners of the warrant, what the warrant authorized.
Counsel, let me interrupt for a minute. We have two warrants here. You're referencing Judge Freeman's warrant from February 26th, I take it. But we also have Judge Mesrick's from March 5th, about a week later. How do we read one four corners without reading both, given that nothing was searched from the first search warrant inventory without reference to the second? In other words, it was much more specific, much more particular, once they got to the point of reviewing what it had been that they'd seized, much like a container.
The first warrant stands on its own, and it authorized on its face not only the seizure of every electronic device, but the search of those electronic devices. The law is absolutely clear that although the police obtained a second warrant, they were not required to do so. The law is also clear that if you have an overbroad warrant, this is Groh versus Ramirez, United States Supreme Court cited in my brief, if you have an overbroad warrant, even if the police limit themselves to what should have been in the warrant and do not take advantage of the full scope of the warrant is still overbroad and is defective. The reasonableness of the police cannot cure a defective warrant. So my answer
to
you.
What about a good faith?
I'm sorry?
Leon argument, a good faith Leon exception to some of this. It seems like if the police limited themselves to what was constitutional, that there might be an argument there.
Well, I mean, the good faith exception has never been adopted by the Minnesota courts. That might be an argument in federal court. I don't see it as an argument here.
There is a case that adopts it at least partially or in limited form and leaves it open to how far we would accept that. And it's a Justice Strauss opinion. So I take a bit of an issue saying it's only in federal court, but it does seem that to the extent that it applies in state court, that if the police officers limited themselves to what would be constitutionally permissible, that there would be some analysis we would have to do.
I think the issue of good faith is whether a reasonable officer would believe that this warrant, which authorized the seizure of every electronic device without limitation from a law office, is reasonable, and I don't think good faith would apply in that situation. So it's not that, the fact that they applied for a second warrant does not save this first warrant. The first application essentially said, this search warrant is overbroad, but don't worry, we're going to particularize it later in a second warrant. Number one, that was not included in the terms of the search warrant itself, and the affidavit does not get incorporated into the warrant. The law on that is clear. But even if the search warrant said that, the Fourth Amendment does not allow, we're going to fix it later. The first search warrant authorized a search of all of Ms. McNeely's files, and for that reason, it was overbroad and unreasonable. I see my time is expiring, and so if the court has no further questions, I'll conclude. Thank you.
May it please the court, counsel, John Schmidt, Assistant Hennepin County Attorney on behalf of the state of Minnesota. No Minnesota law requires specific tasks like a special master or a filter team. This court should announce in a prospective rule, in a precedential opinion, guidelines for situations where the attorney is the target of a criminal investigation. And that rule of law should be grounded in the basic tenets of the Fourth Amendment, which is reasonableness determined on a case-by-case basis. The court can provide safeguards for investigators, prosecutors, trial courts to consider in order to protect both the attorney-client privilege, but also recognize the fact that attorneys cannot use that privilege to shield their own illegal conduct. Now, it's very easy to get lost in the weeds on this case, but it is the very basic and simple premise of reasonableness based on the totality of the circumstances depending on the case that exists. The case that's most on point is State versus Poole. Again, there's no Minnesota law to address this specific situation, but in State versus Poole, the Minnesota Supreme Court addressed a situation where it was a doctor and whose patients had been sexually assaulted by this doctor. In that situation, it is the doctor-patient privilege. That privilege is just as important as the attorney-client privilege. Within that search, police were not just looking for specific individuals. They were looking for victims. They didn't know the victims that existed. They found 58 patients and seized all of their records. And based on that, they found 11 patients where they made charges from them. The Minnesota Supreme Court outlined guidelines in a case-specific analysis that it depends upon the nature of the activity under investigation. And in doing so, they provided some guidelines to consider in the future, having a centralized review. That happened here. Peak was the centralized review that happened in the search of the computer's files. She only turned over those documents that were relevant to this investigation. The officer testified in a normal search of a computer, they get back everything. Here, they only got back the documents that were relevant to these particular victims for these particular allegations. And the police, unlike in Poole, did not do a broad search to look for other victims that could have been swindled by this by the appellant. The police
Counsel, to the extent that there wasn't a filter team or special master, and I agree with you, the law doesn't require it, but to the extent that there wasn't, does that go to the reasonableness of the search?
Well, I disagree about the filter team because I think Ms. Peak is that filter team. And so it's a different agency. She was not involved directly with this investigation other than to do a search of the computer. And she only provided documents that were very specific to the victims involved in this case.
So it sounds like you're saying it would go to the reasonableness, or is there?
It does. Yes, it does go to the reasonableness. Sure, that is something to consider. But when it is not a requirement, it was eminently reasonable here for the police to use somebody who is not associated with their department to conduct a search, and to conduct a search using search terms. This is like a Westlaw search where you put in some search terms and you see the words before and after, and if it was not directly related to this and these allegations, she didn't produce them. Not only did she not produce them, she didn't open the document because she could see that it was not relevant.
When you say that she wasn't part of the same organization, how much insulation is there when, given that she was part of the crime task force?
She is part of the crime task force. She is law enforcement and related to the, you know, associated with the law enforcement. But in terms of, it was a different department, and she was not involved in any of the investigation in particular for these situations. This isn't a situation where they used somebody from their own office down the hall to go do this search. This is somebody from a different department doing a search. And under existing case law, that is reasonable. The other thing Poole mentions is to have first use less intrusive investigative techniques. The police did that here. The police got subpoenas for bank records. They got subpoenas for phone records. They corroborated a lot of the allegations that existed before they even got a warrant to go search her office. The judges carefully reviewed the warrant applications. That's another Poole factor. I think the warrant applications certainly show that. But again, unlike Poole, it's even more reasonable here because they were not looking for files beyond the two victims that were associated here. And they did put limitations on searching the computers and preventing police from discovering different victims that may have been involved. Now, in terms of the first search warrant, which was discussed a bit here, the first search warrant allowed for the police to obtain and seize the following described property and things. And then it lists very specifically, and this is at 826 of the addendum, computers, electronic devices. Nowhere in there does it say searching for electronic files. And it does not say searching on the computers. It is to seize the computers, to seize the electronic devices. Secondly, the affidavit was very clear that the officer said, we will be seeking additional warrants in order to do that search. When an officer says that under oath, he is subjecting himself to various penalties and lots of problems, including Brady Giglio, including sanctions, including perjury.
Counsel, does that, I'm following your line of thinking here, but does that allow an officer to apply for a warrant that he realizes is overbroad as long as he makes that oath that he will get a more specific warrant later?
I don't think that the warrant is overbroad because what the affidavit is asking for and what the warrant authorized was the seizure of the computers, not the search of the computers.
Then why is it necessary to even suggest that you're going to get a second warrant that's more specific?
To make very clear to the judge that we are not searching these computers because the officer was trying to be as reasonable as possible given the circumstances and given the fact that there is no binding precedent that tells the officer this is what you exactly have to do. So it makes it even more reasonable the fact that the officer says, we're going to get a second warrant. We understand she's an attorney. We know what the risks involved are in this case. And so there's a number of things in the affidavit that both limit what the warrant actually authorizes, but limits what the police are allowed to do. And this officer was on the scene, the officer who applied for the warrant was on the scene and watching the execution of the warrant to ensure that everything is done according to what his affidavit said and according to what the warrant authorized. Again, eminently reasonable.
So if the officer's representation had not been included, that I'm gonna apply for an additional search warrant, would this search warrant, this first one, allow the police to search the contents of the computer or just to seize it?
I think under the
What's the state's position?
I think under the terms of the warrant where it's saying the for the following describe property and things, it says computers, it says electronic devices. It doesn't say electronic files. And so I think it is limited within that, and I think had a police without that included in the affidavit gone beyond that, there's some pretty good arguments to say that the officers exceeded
their authority. In your interpretation of that warrant, what is being searched?
The office. The office is being searched, and it is listed right there. Search for the following described premises. And so it is listed at that address in Woodbury, Minnesota. That's what's being searched. And then they are authorized to seize documents showing occupancy. They're authorized to see computers and electronic devices.
The second to last item that says any files, invoices, or documents, it doesn't specify hard copies, digital copies. Do you think that that arguably requires searching the office for files?
I think it for the office, yes. For the computers, no. Because it's specifically listed there of the premise that is searched. And if you take a look at the second warrant and you read them in conjunction, the second warrant is very specific about you are authorized to search these devices. That's a very big distinction that exists between warrant one and warrant two. And I think that limits the authority of the officers. Even if that representation was not made under oath in the affidavit, it limits the authority of the officers. Now, I think that may come in the analysis if that was not made under oath. Perhaps that's less reasonable, and it requires further scrutiny of what the officers represented and what the execution looked like. But given that it was included, and given that this was a careful step-by-step process with prior investigation, a first warrant, the seizure of the items, no search, a second warrant, having an independent person review that, all of that shows that under existing law, this was very reasonable.
So again, I'll ask the same question regarding standard of review. Since it's limited to the four corners, there aren't any findings being made after an evidentiary hearing about this. So it seems that we're either, as Mr. Richmond's arguing, under de novo review or the substantial basis test, putting ourselves in the shoes of the issuing judge to determine if there was a substantial basis to sign something, was it particular enough? So do you think this particularity issue is substantial basis or de novo or something else?
I think it's just like any other search warrant, and it shouldn't be given special treatment when it comes because there's an attorney involved in this. And so in my brief, I said, you know, clearly erroneous for the findings of fact. The findings of fact would go to the execution where there was a hearing on that. But in terms of the four corners, that is de novo. In terms of whether the judge was authorized to sign it, that gets into the substantial basis. But I would agree with opposing counsel that it would be de novo if you're just looking at what's in here and whether that was authorized, not whether it was should be signed. And it should be treated like any other search warrant. Unless the court has any other questions, we ask that you adopt a prospective rule that is in a precedential opinion that is based upon reasonableness in a case-by-case basis, and I will rely on my briefs.
Can I ask just one final thing? So this Ms. McNeil represented criminal defendants, so presumably on that hard drive there was lots of stuff about other defense cases, hypothetically. We don't know what was actually in there. Could any of that, and it was a law enforcement official who reviewed it. So is it the state's position that anything that was found in there, except for what was actually provided to the investigators in this case, is completely off limits?
Yes. And this goes back to the question that you asked counsel, where what is the basis for her to be able to hide behind the privilege? And I agree that she has standing, but that doesn't directly answer the question of, well, why should she be able to assert this? Other clients can absolutely assert it to the extent that any documents come out, any of her clients are charged with other crimes, they can certainly raise the issue that my attorney's computer was seized and I want to know exactly how they got my information. absolutely that is fair game. But when it comes to this particular case of what they were doing and what they were searching for when she is the target of the criminal investigation, it was extremely limited and narrow to just these individuals of the victims involved in this crime. And that's all that was turned over to the investigating police. Thank you.
Go ahead.
The state attempts to argue that the original search warrant authorized the seizure of these electronic devices, but not a review of the content of those devices. First of all,
Counsel, let me interrupt you just for a minute on that issue of this first search warrant. Put yourself in the state's shoes for a minute, and you have an attorney suspected of wrongdoing. How would you have written this warrant application differently than it was written? How would you be specific and still get the information you need at that juncture?
You would say that you want hard files or electronic files that pertain to Mark Wilson in the time period from March of 2018 to November of 2018, bearing on the subject matter of this theft by swindle that has been described in the affidavit.
In order to do that, you would need to seize the computer.
Yes, you would. I don't take issue with the fact that you have to seize the computer. Yes, you would have to seize the entire computer, and you would have to search the entire computer, but the parameters of the search would be set by the search warrant. Here, this search warrant, by its terms, authorizes a search of the contents of these computers and electronic storage devices without limitation. This search warrant says electronic devices which could contain or access files held remotely. And it then says the property or things above described constitutes evidence which tends to show a crime has been committed. Well, a flash drive does not show a crime has been committed. What shows a crime has been committed is the content of that flash drive.
Okay. Now, Judge Freeman has this in front of her, and she sees the affiant has also said that they're going to go any further until they get a second search warrant in the first district to further examine the evidence that is seized. Your position is that that's not sufficient.
Correct. My position is that it's not sufficient to say we'll particularize the warrant later. That the in order to have a search warrant issued, it has to show particularity about the items to be seized. This promise in the affidavit is not incorporated into the search warrant. The overbreadth of the search warrant is based on the four corners of the search warrant. And this idea that, well, he would be subject to a perjury prosecution, that's the exact same argument that was rejected by the Supreme Court in the Franks versus Delaware case, where the state of Delaware said, you don't need Franks hearings, what we now call Franks hearings, evidentiary hearing piercing the four corners, because the affidavit is under oath. Well, that is a frivolous argument. The fact that it is under oath does not change the fact that if it is not in the warrant, it is not in the warrant, period. The state is asking this court, sub silentio, to change the well-established law regarding incorporation of affidavits into search warrants. The law is clear that the search warrant speaks for itself. You cannot have particularity in an affidavit or some other document. Ms. Peek was not a filter team. The government says, the state says Ms. Peek was the filter team. A filter team or a special master is the function of that team is to make determinations of privilege. Ms. Peek was making determinations of relevance. Those are two very different things. She was not competent to make determinations of privilege. That is a judicial determination. And it makes no difference that the privilege was violated by a member of the Dakota County Task Force versus violated by Detective Klingfuss. Either way, the privileges were violated. State versus Poole is completely distinguishable from this case. In that case, because there were juvenile young girls who were being sexually abused by a doctor who would not report this themselves, the police did not even know who the victims of the crime were, which is why they weren't able, unlike this case, to further particularize the warrant. There were no privacy interests of the doctor at stake, whereas here, Ms. McNeely has her own work product privilege, and no constitutional issues at stake. Here, we were talking about the embarrassment of these patients. Here, we are talking about the attorney-client and work product privileges, which go to the basis of the Fifth and Sixth Amendments.
Judge Brian, can I ask I know we're over time, but if I can ask a quick question. So going back to the process issue, so it's your position, really, that only a special master could review and say, oh, all these other files related to other clients, there's privilege here. I mean, but, right? I mean, is that what you're arguing?
I have not, law enforcement
can't, but they were saying, I mean, whether it was privileged or not, they were saying none of this applies. So I guess I'm a little confused about that and what it is on the process end you think needed to happen.
My position is that when there is a search of a law office, immediately following that search, there has to be a hearing, a contested hearing with the attorney, the suspected attorney present, in order to make a determination of what the process should be. In many cases—
Doesn't that open the situation up to possible destruction of evidence?
Well, presumably, the search has already taken place, and—
Oh, so you're talking about a post-search warrant hearing.
Right.
To set up the process after the seizure.
They have seized the documents but have not yet reviewed them.
So,
there are many cases that I have cited in my brief, the Morley case from Colorado, where, the documents are seized, they are deposited with the court, and then a hearing is conducted to determine what are we going to do with these documents. The attorney is given access to the documents so that she can make a representation. Having reviewed these documents, there are 1,500 client files. The following privileges are at stake.
Yeah, you've cleared up my question. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Well, thank you both parties for your arguments this morning and the briefs that you've submitted. We will take the matter under advisement and issue an order.